Hey, Shira, Arielle here. I want to tell our counties about a podcast that they're going to love. It's called The Jordan Harbinger Show, and it's one of Apple's best podcasts of 2018, and it's consistently in the top 50 overall. Jordan Harbinger interviews some pretty big names in a variety of fields, an FBI negotiator, an almost Nobel Prize winner, a former CIA operative, and more. You might recognize some of these names that he's interviewed. Tony Hawk, Chelsea Handler, Malcolm Gladwell, Barbara freaking Boxer, Kobe Bryant, RIP, huge names and incredible interviews.
I listen too, Arielle. Jordan's got hundreds of episodes. So I recommend that you start with the episode on Jonna Mendez. That's episode 344. She's a former chief of disguise in the CIA's Office of Technical Service. How cool does that job sound?
The Jordan Harbinger Show is chock full of stories and lessons, and we cannot wait for you to check it out. He's even produced some great episodes recently on how to work from home and think about your career post-pandemic. The mission of Jordan's show is to make you a better informed, more critical thinker. Find the Jordan Harbinger Show wherever you're listening to our podcast and on Spotify, Apple, and all other podcast apps.
Hi, Shira and Arielle and my fellow counties. This is Bethany calling from Jackson, Mississippi, and you're listening to Counter Programming.
Hi, Arielle.
Hi, Shira.
Hi, Counties.
Welcome to Counter Programming with us. This is your COVID-19 distraction cast, where we acknowledge the existence of the coronavirus, but then take a hard pivot to distract you for approximately 30 minutes.
On this show, we cover anything with the word counter or count in the title. Countertops, Count Dracula, step counters, counterfeit coins, and more. Today's episode, Counter Tenor.
Counter tenor.
Which I had no idea what this was prior to research, so you're in for a ride.
I've got to give a quick shout out to one of our newest counties, Andrea Canny, who suggested this topic. I emceed the Outlier Podcast Festival's virtual summit this past week, where I virtually met Andrea. She has a podcast that explores the art scene in Orlando. It's called The Rise.
Another shout out to the people listening to this podcast on CastBox. Yes, you. We've noticed that a big portion of our listeners come from CastBox, so we wanted to give a signature Counter Programming welcome to you.
Welcome!
I didn't see that one coming, Arielle.
We'd love to hear from more counties about counter topics that you'd like for us to explore. You can send us an email at counterprogrammingshiraarielle@gmail.com or slide into our DMs on Instagram at counterprogrammingpod.
We've been having so much fun with this podcast. We love presenting you with counter facts week after week, and you seem to be enjoying it as well, counties. If that's the case, please leave us a review on Apple. All you have to do is go to the Apple app, give us 5 stars, and then leave a little comment. We'll read it on the show, and you'll get that podcast shout-out that you've always dreamed of. How cool it'll be to hear your name on a pod.
All right, Shira, let's hop into it. What are we covering today? Counter tenor! Among our regular segments where we explain this counter, we've also got an interview for you with a real live counter tenor. He absolutely rocks.
Before we dive into the world of music, Arielle, how the heck are you?
Things are, you know, it's many, many weeks of this pandemic. I want to give you something fresh and new, but truthfully, the only thing that I've really been changing up is my consumption of media. So I started watching this show on Netflix called Waco. And as you know, but the counties don't know, I'm obsessed with religious cults and the mythos behind that. So it was a really great miniseries, really intense. Now I need something lighthearted. Do you have any recommendations?
Well, I just finished Schitt's Creek.
Ooh.
And I sobbed at the end.
My baby girl leaving me so soon.
But it was like the perfect level of lighthearted, but like meaningful for right now.
That'll be my next thing then.
Did we ever go to Waco together when we worked in Jackson?
I've been to Waco. I actually went to where the compound was, where the Branch Davidian compound was. It was kind of eerie.
I went to Waco, but I went to Magnolia Market. Not the compound.
And I don't know if this is true, but in the story that I tell myself, when I went to the outside of the compound, I saw a burnt Barbie doll, but I don't think that's true.
Any story that starts with "in the story that I tell myself," I don't
think. Sure. So I went with our friend Leia. So Leia, if you're listening, please let me know. Did we see a burnt Barbie doll? Anyway, Shira, How are you? Let's move on from that.
I'm good. My birthday was this past weekend.
Happy birthday.
Thank you to all the counties for the birthday love. My roommate and I decided to go on a potato crawl through Manhattan. So for those of you who don't know what a potato crawl is, we ate different potatoes from different restaurants around the city. So we both supported small businesses and ate one of my favorite foods.
That's very beautiful. And you stimulated the economy.
Exactly.
Thank you for doing that. Another year older, another year wiser, and now more and more prepared to talk about countertenor, am I right?
Oh, yeah. Once you turn 27, you just gain all this counter knowledge.
Let's give some larger context into the countertenor world so that non-musically inclined people, aka me, know what we're talking about.
It's funny because I was in choir in school and I like did theater and stuff, and I still feel like I learned so much from our conversation and about countertenors from our research. I feel like I was more chosen and like put in the choir for my spirit and energy.
You were chosen?
And less for my, hey, I made it into chamber choir. But right, they always referenced me as the person to watch for like performance and not musical talent.
That's great though. That's such a compliment.
Yeah, but I feel like I should have known more about this.
So just so everybody knows, we are going to play an interview for you soon, and it's going to be great. We wanted the interview to be like 10 to 12 minutes long, but it was so good. And it had so, our interview subject, Aria Nussbaum-Cohen, is so well-versed in what he does for a living that we decided we needed to play the entire interview for you. But first, let's talk a little bit about the standard vocal range system. Shira, would you like to jump in there?
So vocal range is the range of pitches that a human voice can phonate. A new word for us, or for me, sorry. Its most common application is within the context of singing, where it is used as a defining characteristic for classifying singing voices into voice types.
So starting from the highest female voice, that's the soprano. Or do we say soprano? I don't know how that goes.
We're from New York, so we say soprano, I feel like. I don't know. That sounds like an accent thing, not a...
Right or wrong.
Aria. Yeah. Then you have a mezzo soprano. Then you have a mezzo soprano.
Then you have a contralto. Contralto, the lowest female voice.
Then you have a tenor, the highest male voice.
Then a baritone. A male voice.
And a bass, the lowest male voice.
It's all about that bass. So, Shira, where does countertenor fit into all of this?
A countertenor is a type of classical male singing voice whose vocal range is equivalent to the female contralto or the mezzo-soprano voice types. And so I guess it goes between, we would say, above tenor and those two. But like on a male side, countertenors often are baritones or tenors at core, but can occasionally use their vocal range to go even higher during performances.
Let's define countertenor for all the counties. It is the highest male adult singing voice, which is sometimes distinguished from the male alto voice by its strong, pure tone.
You're going to meet Aria soon in our interview, but he sent us some YouTube clips that he said we could use to demonstrate the countertenor voice. So here's one. Wow.
Wow. I mean, he really does have a pure voice. He's like an angel.
I read an interesting article called The Grisly History of the Men Who Sing Like Women from the BBC, and we discussed some of that with Aria, but I thought this quote captured my experience listening to him sing. A classical countertenor, this powerful yet ethereal pure noise emanating from a grown man, transports you somewhere else altogether. It is unique, startling, and once heard, can never be forgotten.
Oh man, I will never forget Aria.
Oh, I know. It was such a good, fun interview.
I just want to say before we go into our interview, I watched some YouTube videos featuring countertenors to try to understand what it was all about. And the funniest comment that I saw was by username Kamel Haj, who said that he thought countertenors were singing bartenders. I wish. A little about how the muscles work when it comes to a countertenor using their whole body. As explained by Leston Davies, who is a Grammy Award winning countertenor, quote, it's a voice produced by not using one's modal or normal speaking voice, but the higher range that occurs when the combination of larynx muscles and vocal cord position are changed in such a way that the air passing through the cords vibrates a much thinner outer layer, end quote. So it's definitely when you learn to be a countertenor, you are learning to manipulate the muscles in your body. And that's amazing. It's clearly an amazing profession that Arye, as you'll see, and so many other countertenors before him, it takes a lot of work.
Yeah, it's not just like you can't just get on stage and do it. Like you really have to hone the craft. Okay, I feel like we've been hyping up the interview so much, and I think we just need to share it with all of our countees.
Yeah, let's jump into it. He is going to tell you what it's like to sing and perform opera. And he also is really well versed in the history behind the opera in general and countertenors specifically. So let's do it. Here is our interview with Arye Nussbaum-Cohen. Welcome, Arye. We are pumped to have you here. Turns out that you and I know each other. We went to summer camp together, Camp Ramah, which sadly was just canceled for the summer. I have a vague memory of you singing Age of Aquarius from Hair the Musical. Is that possible?
Oh, yes. That was that summer at Camp Ramah. That was my song. I was like obsessed with Hair, and I was just like, you know, starting to really love singing. And for whatever reason, my annoying teenage self, that was like the thing. People would ask me to sing that song on cue, and I would. The Age of Aquarius.
What?
It was quite a time.
Man, I love that.
We have a lot of countertenor questions for you. But before we dive into those, we wanted to properly introduce you to all of our counties because we've got a real star on our hands.
I thought everyone would know me from my performances of the Age of Aquarius at Camp Ramah the Berkshires. Is that not the case?
For the few people who don't, so let's make sure to read your very impressive bio. And
okay.
Shira, why don't you and I switch off every paragraph because there are many.
I think that sounds great. And if we say anything incorrectly, please correct us. Arye Nussbaum-Cohen is acclaimed as a young star and a complete artist by the New York Times. Arye has quickly been identified as one of opera's rising young stars. His first commercial recording project, the world premiere of Kenneth Fuchs' Poems of Life with the London Symphony Orchestra, won a 2019 Grammy in the Best Classical Compendium category.
Here are some other awards Arye has won. The 2019 Sullivan Foundation Award, third place at the 2019 edition of Placido Domingo's Operalia, first prize and Audience Choice Award at the 2018 Dallas Opera Guild Voice Competition. In his breakout season, 2016-17, he was named Grand Finals winner of the Metropolitan Opera National Council Auditions, and he was the recipient of a Sarah Tucker Study Grant from the Richard Tucker Music Foundation.
He also won first prize of the Houston Grand Opera Eleanor McCollum Competition. He won the Irvin Scherzer Award for the George London Foundation. Arye also became the first countertenor in the history of the Houston Grand Opera Studio during the 2017-2018 season.
I love that. The first in history. So fun. Arye has had so many honors and has played so many important roles in operas throughout the U.S., and I'm sure we'll discuss them in more detail. But since we only have a short time, let's shout out where you honed your craft. Arye earned a bachelor's degree in history from Princeton University with a concentration in intellectual and cultural history and received academic certificates in vocal performance and Judaic studies. Woo!
Woo! L'chaim!
Arye, so awesome. You've got so much going on, and we are so honored to have you here. The way that we came about this interview was interesting. Prior to about 2 weeks ago, had no idea what a countertenor was, how it fit into the larger vocal range scale. And it just so happens that the person that I remember from summer camp is a countertenor. So that's awesome.
Such a small world. I love it.
Shira, why don't you take us into our questions for Arye?
Having a highly specialized skill like this obviously takes crafting, understanding, and nurturing. When did you first start singing? And tell us a little bit about your upbringing in general.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I was a musical kid, but I didn't grow up in a musical family, especially not classical music. My dad is a big kind of deadhead and sort of hippie. And so I grew up listening to The Grateful Dead and Phil Lesh and Bob Dylan and Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young, all these kinds of forms of music. being a countertenor was definitely not on my radar. But I went when I was a kid. I joined the Brooklyn Youth Chorus. I joined in, I think, sixth grade, which was just down the block from the Jewish school I was attending in Brooklyn, Hanna Senish Community Day School. And it turned out to be the
shout out
HSCDS. Where are we at? But so Hanna Senish happened to be near this choir, and it turned out to be one of the two kind of preeminent children's choirs of New York City. And we got to do these amazing gigs. I mean, we were singing backup for Elton John and Billy Joel and Sting and James Taylor. Yeah. And we were also singing a lot of amazing classical stuff. We were singing at Carnegie Hall and with the New York Philharmonic all the time, these sorts of things. So amazing experiences as a kid. And then when it was time to go to high school, I wanted to kind of keep singing for fun, but keep singing. So I applied just to basically the arts high schools in New York, and I ended up at LaGuardia High School of the Arts, made famous in Fame, the movie and musical. And I had an amazing experience there, but mainly just singing in choirs. So I had no idea what a countertenor was, but I was in this great choir, the Brooklyn Youth Chorus. And when my voice dropped when I was, I don't know, 12 or 13, something like that, I wanted to stay in the choir. And so the choir was a treble choir. So it was mostly girls and then about 10 boys whose voices hadn't dropped. But we would just sung with Elton John and Billy Joel and all these folks, and I didn't want to leave. So I kind of tried to finagle and keep singing the high notes that were now no longer natural. And they had me kind of re-audition for the choir, and they gave me, you know, a passing grade and allowed me to stay. And I was a very dedicated chorister at every rehearsal. And it was like 3 or 4 rehearsals a week. It was a big commitment. So they let me stay in the choir. And that's kind of how I became a countertenor. So there was no kind of aha moment of realizing I had this kind of higher singing voice as an adult male. It was really just I wanted to stay in that children's choir. So wow. It was kind of a happy accident. Yeah, happy accident.
You just wanted to keep hanging out with Elton John.
Exactly. And I mean, hard to complain about that. That Elton John gig was definitely my number one. This actually reminds me of my kind of Age of Aquarius days, because I have a big personality, and this was especially true when I was a kid. I've kind of calmed down over the years, but we had the highlight of all highlights with the Brooklyn Youth Chorus was singing backup for Elton. Sold out Madison Square Garden. It was his 60th birthday concert, and it was his 60th concert at the Garden, breaking the all-time record for most concerts at the Garden. And it was just this crazy night. And I kind of had grown up a little bit on Elton John, but hadn't really realized how cool this was and kind of any of this as a kid. You know, you're just going along with what your parents are telling you to do. You don't really realize how cool it is until you're a little bit older. But the Elton John gig was like this incredible thing. And I was having the time of my life just being in the Garden, feeding off of this energy. And whoever was running the camera that was kind of showing up on the Megatron spotted this like shaggy haired chubby Jewish kid rocking a yarmulke who was having yarmulke and all, and I was having the time of my life. And and so they like pumped me up on the Jumbotron, I mean, like 90 times over the course of the concert. They still broadcast this concert on the Madison Square Garden like TV network. And every couple of months, a friend like texts me and is like, oh my God, were you like in this Elton John concert in like 2007? I'm like, yep, that was me. But no, and I got recognized by some Elton fans like walking out of the arena. They were like, hey, are you that Jewish kid who was dancing? So it's like, and I often say it's all been downhill since singing back up for Elton at a sold out Garden, even if things have been going pretty well these last few years. So all that to say, obviously I wanted to stay in the choir, and that's kind of how I became a countertenor. But then after that, I went over to LaGuardia where I had a great experience, but again, just singing in choirs a little bit solo, but just kind of as part of the school curriculum, really just a hobby. And then when it was time to apply to college, I didn't apply to conservatories or anything like that. I wanted to go into public policy was my plan.
Oh, wow.
So I ended up at Princeton, where I was originally a Woodrow Wilson School major studying public policy. I planned on maybe going to law school and going into policy work. And then it was while I was at Princeton, the end of my freshman year, I won a free ticket from the music department at Princeton to see an opera at the Met. And that was my first time seeing an opera. I had never actually sat down and seen an opera. And it changed my life. I absolutely loved it. And I just, I was just really blown away by the kind of the grandeur and just the grand emotions that these people were portraying. And I just kind of felt like that's what I want to do. I want to try and do that. Yeah, it's a good story. And I'm forever indebted to the people who donated this Met subscription to the university. You know, and it was like a raffle.
I can't believe that if you hadn't won that ticket, you might not be on that path. So
I know. Well, and my favorite thing too is that they had this raffle, you know, it was like 12 times over the course of the year. And they put up a little sign in the lobby of the music building saying, today, Met and Opera raffle, you know, enter upstairs in the office. And I would always go put my name in just because I was like, oh, cool. Yeah, it'd be cool to go to an opera. You know, I don't really know much about that. And I was entering every single time and I only won probably the, you know, ninth or 10th time, which was when it was La Boheme. And I knew nothing about opera. But the opera that I happened to win my free ticket for is La Boheme, which is perhaps the most famous opera of all time. It's like the most classic. It's the best first opera you could ever see. And the Met's production of it. Yeah, exactly. Pro tip. If you're opera curious or not, give it a whirl. La Boheme is a great one. But the Met, especially their production of La Boheme, is this beautiful, grand, kind of, you know, ridiculously sumptuous production. The last production actually left in their repertory by Franco Zeffirelli, who's kind of the most famous kind of old school opera director. And anyway, needless to say, it was really the perfect first opera to see. And I could have won the raffle to see some kind of funky 20th century opera that would not have been as great a sell for someone who knew nothing about the art form. So it really worked out well, and I'm glad I won the raffle for that one.
So what does your schedule look like? Obviously, it's a little different right now, but what does a professional opera singer's normal schedule look like pre-quarantine?
So yeah, there's no 2 days that are the same really. But so I finished my training about 6 months ago at the San Francisco Opera. So I was in the Houston Grand Opera Studio and then the Adler Fellowship Program at San Francisco Opera, which are these kind of residency programs, which I always say the kind of closest comparison is like a doctor doing residency where, you know, you're sort of half working, but still training a little bit, you know, you're being paid, but you're not being paid that much. But it's this kind of honing your skills sort of stage. And I was really lucky to do these two kind of really top tier programs, which as a countertenor especially is kind of rare to get to do those residency programs. So I was really lucky to get to kind of hone my skills at two of the biggest opera companies in America. But so after I finished the program, I kind of graduated into being a full-time freelancer. So I was already doing a good amount of freelance work, which was great and kind of eased the transition. But yeah, so I have an agent who, you know, manages my bookings and, with whom it's fun. Mm-hmm. So we kind of craft a path together. And yeah, so I kind of travel around, I would say, kind of two big parts of what we do, one of which is opera performances. And so that is kind of staged opera productions at an opera company. And those are longer stints away from home where usually you're in that place for about 6 weeks at a time, usually about 3 weeks of rehearsals and then about 3 weeks of performances. But there are some longer contracts. I mean, some of the contracts I have coming up in the next few years are a 3-month contract or something like that in a given city. So there's those longer term opera contracts. And then we do concert engagements, which are usually shorter, about a week or 2 weeks. So yeah, so I've been kind of really enjoying doing both of those things here around the States and singing with some great orchestras and opera companies and some great things in Europe. Sadly, some of the things that were canceled were things I was really looking forward to, but opera is the opera industry plans really far in advance. So it's nice that I have other things to look forward to in 2021, 2022, 2023.
That far ahead. Wow.
Yeah. I would say my latest gig right now, I think is 2024.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Well, and what's funny is that, like, obviously things are planned really far out, but there's so much uncertainty right now. And so I'm trying to like work on the roles that I'm doing in a couple years, but even that, it's hard to like really be artistically motivated right now. I don't know. It's a weird time.
We'd love to kind of know, as you're training for something, as you're honing a role, as you're making sure that your auditions are ready to go for the concerts that you're putting on in a given city, what is it? Do you become friends with the people that you're working with? Is it more of a competitive spirit? What's the vibe?
I would say it's definitely a friendly spirit.
I kind of think of the show Mozart in the Jungle. Did you watch that?
I love that show. Yeah.
Did you watch that, Shira?
I don't think I saw that.
It's a great show. It's about the New York Philharmonic. Is that right?
Yeah, it's like a fake orchestra that's modeled after the New York Philharmonic. Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I think there are maybe more power dynamics in things like an orchestra or a choir that it's the same people there every week kind of with each other, especially an orchestra because they are competing for their kind of seat assignments. And it's a big prestige thing that like, oh, shoot, I got to assign, you know, third row, second chair instead of second row, second chair, whatever. Whereas I think what's nice as singers is that we're living this itinerant kind of lifestyle, obviously, and we're meeting new people all the time and in new productions and concerts with new people all the time. And everyone's, you know, really rooting for each other. So there's definitely some great camaraderie and, you know, we keep our eyes on our competition maybe, but there's, you know, it's a very friendly kind of atmosphere.
What are your like future plans as a countertenor? I mean, you kind of went into what some of the concerts you're doing and stuff, but what is, I guess, like the career path look like moving forward.
Totally. So sadly, we're like very restricted about what we're allowed to say publicly, only what's been publicly announced. So, but yeah, what I think I'm really looking forward to in the next couple of seasons is that I have a really great mix of roles that, and I can talk more about kind of what periods of music a countertenor kind of sings music from, but I have a really nice mix of the old and the new. So as a countertenor, we sing music that was written largely before 1750 in the kind of Baroque era.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah. And it's and we're singing music for the Baroque era that was mostly written for castrati.
I've read the Wikipedia page and it,
love it.
It seemed like there was a dark history.
There is. It's a bit of a mixed history, but it's also just so interesting. So these castrati, it started out as a practice kind of in churches for church choirs, we believe. Wow. And that's where it ended as well in the Vatican. And the last castrato actually died. Actually, here, I'm going to do a little guess when. When do you think the last castrato died?
We love games.
So I would guess the last castrato, I would like to believe the last castrato died in like the 1800s.
Okay.
But.
What about you, Shira?
I'm nervous that it's going to be more recent than that. I'll say 1910.
Very close. The last castrato, as we know him, was Alessandro Moreschi, and he died in 1922.
Ugh.
So much later than you would think.
Yeah.
Much later than you'd think. Let's quickly, can we define castrato? I think a lot of people may have used their context clues and figured it out, but just in case.
Absolutely. So these castrati are men who were largely singers who were castrated, usually when they were about 7 or 8 years old.
Wow, that young.
And it was this interesting practice where obviously it was kind of condoned, but it was sort of under the table. So it was usually described, there was kind of an unwritten rule that these boys had quote unquote farming accidents is what they would call them, where somehow they lost their testicles. And basically, so when you're castrated about 7 or 8 years old, your body develops hormonally, obviously, in all sorts of strange ways, but it creates this kind of other human, I don't know, kind of category where it's not really the voice of a man, but it's also definitely not the voice of a woman. And it's this really unique quality. But these castrati grew so that basically the way their hormones developed, they had lung capacities about double the size of a modern man.
Wow.
They had these huge rib cages and really small waists, and they became these huge celebrities. So the castrati were the people who made opera into the kind of public art form that we know it as. So opera had developed as just like a small court art form where, you know, kings and princes, whatever, were commissioning operas to be written for them. And then these castrati kind of came around and had such huge, they were just so popular that opera kind of exploded. And I mean, in Venice at one point, you had dozens of opera houses within just the city of Venice, where every night all these different castrati were performing. We have all these incredible stories of women fainting in the theaters or throwing their panties on the stage. I mean, really crazy stories. And the castrati were also players. I mean, they...
What?
I don't know how much you want me to go to. It's a little bit. So basically, our research shows that the castrati, despite not being able to produce children because they had been castrated, they were able to get erect and they were able to have intercourse, essentially. And so it became the ultimate thing because they were these huge celebrities. And women could have sex with them.
Control.
Exactly. Sex with no consequences. So the castrati really got around.
Wow.
They really got around. And they were really kind of the first modern celebrities as we know celebrity. I mean, they were really the first.
All countertenors, like, is everyone as versed in the history, or are you someone who's very interested in history?
Yeah. As you may notice from my degree. No, I'm very interested in history. And I think I'm probably more versed maybe in the history of castrati and countertenors than your average countertenor. And I actually, so at Princeton, every degree involves a lot of independent research. You write all these junior papers and then everyone has to write a big senior thesis to graduate. And so the reason I majored in history was because I wanted to study the history behind the music that I was singing. So I did a ton of research about castrati, and I did research projects in the National Archives in Venice and in the secret Vatican archives in Rome and all sorts of fun castrato history. And actually my senior thesis was about the kind of demise of the castrati. And so the first thing that piqued my curiosity was, oh my God, this last castrato lived until 1922. And so then I kind of wanted to figure out how it went on so long, because in opera, the public kind of lost taste for castrati around 1750, and we didn't see them on opera stages anymore at all. And yet in the church, castrati kind of continued to be around, and they were really protected by the Catholic Church up until that point in the early 20th century. So that I spent a whole year kind of delving into castrato history. And if anyone's interested, give me a ring.
It probably enhances your experience, like doing these roles and like getting into these characters and singing this music so much.
Exactly. Well, and my favorite thing is when I'm preparing a role to bring all of that to bear, I do a ton of character research and I read all these primary sources, especially the kind of operas that I perform. Most of these characters are historical characters and the stories are taken from either, you know, Tacitus or their biblical stories and all these things. So I love reading all sorts of primary and secondary sources to try and understand these characters as they are kind of portrayed historically. But then there's the other interesting element of then accessing the character as it's portrayed by that opera composer and by that librettist who wrote the text of that opera. So I love kind of digging into that stuff. And some of the characters I've gotten to portray have been also very kind of gratifying as a member of the tribe, as a Jew. Like one of my sort of signature roles so far has been King David in Handel's Saul.
Ooh, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've read so many books about King David and, you know, all the sort of original source material from, you know, from the Old Testament, from the prophets and anyway, so it's been really fun to kind of dig into a character like that.
Just to backtrack really quickly on the castrati, It's castrati, right?
Yeah.
Is the reason that the practice went on for so long, is it because women's voices were not welcome in the church, or there was some sort of ban against that?
Yeah, exactly. So female public singing was banned in the church until about that time. But what's interesting is that the kind of public taste for castrati had ended, but in the church it was still accepted. And the Catholic Church, kind of as an institution, protected the castrati as this tradition that they viewed as totally sacred. So obviously it was an invented tradition. But so I kind of ended up doing this whole historical deep dive that showed that basically the only thing that really ended the castrati's reign was the Vatican losing its political power, actually, in 1875 with the unification of Italy. So if that hadn't happened, there could very well still be castrated men singing St. Peter's Basilica.
Wow. Well, okay. I think that will transition us pretty seamlessly to my next question, which is, what are some ways that people misunderstand your profession? And what are some myths about opera singers or the opera in general that you want to dispel?
Yeah, I think there's just a big myth that it's this really stuffy thing. And I think a lot of that has been bad PR, but there's also just a lot of just misconceptions where people think, oh, every opera is in a foreign language and I won't understand anything that's going on. Okay, yes, a lot of operas that we perform are in the original languages in which they were written, but there are subtitles either on the back of the seat in front of you or above the stage as you're watching. So you always have a minute, you know, second by second translation of what's going on. And just in general, I think we have work to do about just showing people that it can be this really amazing experience that it doesn't have to be such a formal, stuffy thing. And I think one of the things that appeals to a lot of people about opera is that kind of formal nature. And it's something that I love, that you can put on a suit or a nice gown if you want, but also you can go in jeans and a t-shirt. You know, you can go in absolutely anything to go see the opera. And the thing that I love, the thing that really swept me away about it and made me fall in love with it, is this kind of larger than life nature of what we do. And so if you think about the kind of attention span that we have in the 21st century, we're used to everything being so kind of quick, and TV and all this stuff is super quick. And opera, like other kind of classical arts, ballet, et cetera, it is just kind of a different sense of time, which I find is even more gratifying during, you know, kind of our modern era than ever before, because we're used to everything being so quick and kind of hyper, that what's so amazing about it is that it explores these deep human emotions in such a huge, expansive way. You know, people joke, there's no opera about going to the supermarket to like go pick out some tomato sauce. You know, it's about life and death and love and betrayal and all these things. But what's amazing about it is that if you go, and I just encourage everyone to go one time and give it a chance, and what you have to do is just change your conception of time, where if you're going to expect everything to be the same super quick kind of hyper way that we are accustomed to in the 21st century, you're going to be bored. But if you go in and you're willing to just kind of sit back and give it some time and change your kind of perception of time, when we get to these huge emotions and the soaring music, I mean, it just washes over you. And I think it just portrays those emotions in such a deeper way than anything that's super quick really can. So that's my kind of big sale for opera to people who might not be interested in it, to kind of give it that one chance and just give it a try.
Yeah. You sold me. Once this is all over, I want to go. Was listening to you on Spotify before this, more as a research, and I had it on in the background as I was like my bed and stuff. And I was like, wow, I didn't think I would enjoy this. Like I was like really engaged, and I found it like very calming to start my day. And I was like, oh, I think I could dabble a little more.
Yeah.
So
We have kind of a book / movie / now opera club going on with our counties on our podcast. And, you know, for every subject that we've studied, there's been kind of a natural book pairing to go along with it. So one of them, during our Granite episode, we want to watch this Netflix series called Granite Flats. What else, Shira? Last week, we talked about something with Lisa with the counterfeit.
The book called The Fake Millionaire by the guy who counterfeited $12 million so that he could become a millionaire.
Yes, of course. And then now I think we have to go to an opera. So we will eventually, once things become normal again, all of our counties, we're going to make an outing to an opera.
Fantastic. Hopefully an opera with a countertenor, because it is a kind of more rare voice type. So
okay. It's
not what you're seeing every day at the opera. It's a little bit more specialized. So actually, I kind of started talking about this, but didn't go all in. So as countertenors, we sing music that was written kind of up until 1750, when the kind of taste for castrati was lost in opera. And then we sing music from about post 1950, which is when the countertenor, as we know it, kind of reemerged. When we kind of look back at the Baroque era, it shows, basically, these historical studies showed there were actually a lot of countertenors singing then in addition to the castrati in different places. So in England, it was mostly countertenors, you know, for sacred works, especially. I don't know, there's all sorts of weird distinctions. But then the countertenor kind of reemerged with this man, Alfred Deller, in the mid 20th century, who was a guy who sang kind of in church choir and sort of stepped out and said, hey, you know, I'm not a castrato, but look, I have this kind of high voice that, you know, that I can use to sing maybe some of these lost works. And the voice type has really kind of grown from there and really exploded it with like kind of my generation of countertenors, for example. Every generation, there have been just more and more. And now there are so many great countertenors. It's a really wonderful thing. And so many different types of countertenors. So countertenors were viewed as this kind of voice type that it's like, oh yeah, this is what countertenors sound like, boom. As compared to if you're a soprano, there are, you know, 12 different varieties of soprano within soprano. And something that I think is really interesting is just seeing how it's just really grown the kind of appreciation for, oh, there are so many different types of countertenors as well. And that's really kind of happened in the last 10 years or so, maybe.
When I was doing some research before this, most of the people I found who are listed as countertenors were people who are singing opera or like more classical music. Are there any, I guess, like more poppy mainstream people that are identified as countertenors? Or
great question. This is something I meant to talk about earlier. We view the countertenor as like this bizarre, you know, kind of zygote. I don't know. It's like this weird thing. But countertenor sort of style singing is so prevalent in all pop music. I mean, from Prince to the Bee Gees to Sam Smith to Justin Bieber. I mean, every one of these people, if you think of like Sam Smith, you say, you know, whatever. It's like they're popping into their countertenor kind of constantly. And it's just something that we associate with pop music now. But it's funny that in classical music, it is still viewed as this kind of weird thing.
Well, because I just watched Ben Platt's Netflix special the other day, and he...
Amazing.
Definitely.
Is he a countertenor?
So again, these people that you wouldn't identify as a countertenor outside of classical music, but they use countertenor kind of type singing. You know, most men in pop music are using what's called falsetto, or, you know, the way that we kind of sing as a countertenor. That range is very, very common.
Well, you are a wealth of knowledge, and we know that a lot of people are going to be inspired by this interview. If you could give any advice to aspiring countertenors out there, what would you say?
Ooh, my big advice to kind of young singers in general is a great piece of advice that I kind of gleaned from watching the famous mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato. She does these amazing master classes online that she's kind of done for many years at different schools and different places. And she talked about that kind of number one thing you need as an artist is to have something to sing about. And that young singers, especially, and I think this is true of people in all sorts of art forms, people tend to get so kind of narrowly focused on, oh, I need to, you know, work on my craft, which is all true. But if you don't have life experiences to sing about and to kind of share art about, what's the whole point? So my kind of big advice to young singers, countertenors, and other young singers is to just go out there and experience life and to travel. And I don't know, I had so many amazing experiences while I was at Princeton is really where my life changed, where I got so much amazing funding from Princeton to just go to these foreign countries and cities and just live alone for a month or 3 months and learn other languages and just kind of immerse yourself in these experiences that shape you as a person. And I think that that is what has kind of given me a lot to say artistically, is those sorts of experiences. And as a countertenor too, just to always be kind of finding your own voice, never trying to kind of copy, oh, you know, person X is my favorite countertenor. Mm-hmm. Let me try and sound like them. You know, don't go about it. They are them and you are you. And to just always really try and bring out the best in your own voice.
We would love for you to sing whatever you want to sing.
Just like a few notes. If you need some inspiration, you can sing the name of our podcast, Counterprogramming with Shira and Ariel.
Okay, Counterprogramming with Shira and Ariel. Okay, let me think of what kind of tune. Should I do it super operatically or do we want? Yes, okay. Hopefully, we'll see how the mic kind of does.
Yeah, this will be interesting.
Exactly. Counterprogramming with you and Ariel. I don't know, something like that. I don't know. Okay.
That was beautiful. Oh,
wait, okay.
Counterprogramming with you and Ariel.
Wow! That was amazing. I hope the mic picked it up. And if not, then we will... we'll just try to relay how amazing it really was to everybody.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you guys so much for having me. Really fun to be on with you and explore the wonderful world of the counter tenor.
Yeah. Ariel Nussbaum-Cohen, it was a pleasure.
I love it.
Wow, Ariel. It was such a pleasure to chat with Ariel. He was so chill for such a star. If you can't get enough of Ariel, like us, you can check him out on Spotify.
Shira, how can they find him on Spotify? Because I know you were listening to him on Spotify before the interview.
Well, I typed in his name and then I clicked the shuffle button.
Nice.
His name is Ariel Nussbaum-Cohen.
And we'll put all of that in the show notes so you can check it out.
Also, get in touch with us if you want to go on the opera field trip with us once this whole quarantine situation is over and done with.
Ariel has the most gorgeously designed website we've ever seen. Honestly, it took everything in me to not ask him about his web designer while we were interviewing him, but Shira told me that that would not be a relevant question. You can check out his website. He's at arielnussbaumcohen.com. And again, we'll link to all that in the show notes.
Counties, it's been a pleasure. We've really been around the counter world for this podcast. Kitchens, exercise, coins, and now singing. We've got the census, people counters to look forward to, as well as counterterrorism. But what shall we cover next?
Shira, I think a lot of people during this quarantine, we're at week, I don't know, 10, 20, what, I don't even know where we are. I think a lot of people are experiencing counterproductivity. So I think that would be a fun topic to cover. What do you think?
I think everyone could use some tips and tricks on how to counter. Well, I think how to counter.
yes. We can do a list of top five ways to counter productivity. So just you can cross that out and it's just called productivity.
The double negative or something?
Yeah. All right, counties, we are heading out. But before we do, we need your voice. At the beginning of this episode, you heard from our friend Bethany. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, Nath.
She rocks, and you can be that type of famous, too. All you have to do is record a voice clip on your phone and send it to counterprogrammingshiraariel@gmail.com. Shira, what would that voice clip sound like?
Thanks for asking, Ariel. Hi, I'm, insert your name here, recording from where you're recording from, and you're listening to Counterprogramming with Shira and Ariel.
Oh, Shira, great job. That's why we pay you the big bucks.
Oh, yes, the big ones.
Let's wrap it all up. Thank you to Ariel Nussbaum-Cohen for enlightening us this week. You absolutely crushed it. Thank you, Ariel. I know you're listening, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ariel. I can't wait to listen to more of your music.
Thanks, as always, to our amazing sound guru, Daniel Turek. Find his work and get in touch at robotslap.com.
Our music is by Jason Shaw, and it's called Tennessee Hayride. It's not quite the same as Aria singing Handel's David, but it's a close second, right?
It's a pretty close second. I love Tennessee Hayride. By the way, I reached out to my sister, Margot, who just graduated from college, and she's proficient in like Photoshop and all that stuff, to try to figure out if she could Photoshop us onto a hayride.
Oh my God, I can't wait to see that. We're counting on you, Margot.
Very much counting. Bye, Shira.
Bye, Ariel.
Bye, counties.
Bye, counties. Bye.